Sir Bob Geldof is a man who never takes no for an answer. The lead singer of the punk rock band Boomtown Rats is an acclaimed singer-songwriter, and of course he's just as well known for his political activism and charity fundraising for Africa. Along with Midgeur, he founded Band Aid and went on to organise the massive Live Aid concerts in 1985. But it's his music that's bringing him back to Northern Ireland next month to play a Boomtown Rats gig at Hollywood's Harmony Live Festival. I spoke to him earlier and asked where he gets his energy from. When he's drunk, it's hard to understand what Billy says. But then he mumbles in his coffee and he suddenly roars, it's a rat trap, Judy! And we've been...
Necessity. It's the mother of invention, don't you know? And desperation is probably the father of necessity.
Oh, come on. Bob Geldof cannot be desperate for anything. You're a walking legend. You've been around for a while now. You've been... Boomtown Rats, 40-odd years. Surely this is something that just comes natural to you.
It does come natural, but, I mean, I sort of invent each day, you know. You wake up. I've never done 9 to 5, so I've got nowhere to go. You know, I wake up and you've got stuff to do. And in your head, you go nuts if, you know, you start panicking if there's not stuff to do. One is boredom and... You know, it's a problem for me, and I think loads of people like myself, that boredom is like a key to a sort of black dog. I don't mean a depressive state, but a melancholic state. Yeah. And unless I keep frantically busy, exhaustingly busy, then I am prone to lapse into that sort of melancholy, and I don't like it. And so you keep doing stuff. And then, like, you know, you work for a living, like, you know, cash, like anybody else, you know.
Money. Is money still really that relevant to you? I guess is the assumption that we have of certain people, certain stars, that they've made their money. So now when they do these things, it's purely just for the love of it.
Well, it is for the love of it because, the music is essential. Yeah, it really is absolutely critical. It's the only thing I think I do well. Others may differ. It's the only thing that I do that's absolutely instinctive and intuitive. As soon as I walk out on stage with the Rats, then I am deeply comfortable being Bobby Boomtown. And he isn't the rational or seemingly rational sane person talking to you this morning. It's very, again, this, sorry about the words, it's very liberating. It feels like, you know, you float free and you do and you say things that you couldn't possibly say the minute you walk off stage or behave like. The band start up and I go nuts.
Do you find it difficult then when you step away from the stage and that limelight, the energy that you get from an audience when you're performing, then... I assume that high must be so intense that when you walk off stage, and that's quite difficult to adjust.
It's a really good question because it lasts about an hour and a half. And what I like, my favourite time in life is after the gig, and the gig has kicked off, and we're in the dressing room, and everyone's sweaty and very, very exhausted, but still up. And there's all the chat and the camaraderie. That hour is fantastic because you're still up there and you're you've just had a triumph an artistic triumph if you like, or a musical triumph or some experience, and then you go back to the hotel, and but I don't mind that because and so it goes back to your previous questions because I fill up the time with all sorts of other stuff. Yeah. That I want to do or that I feel I should do. To go to your other question is about the money thing, which, you know, I don't want to avoid questions. In my head, I've got to work for every penny. In my head, it's still back being a kid in Dublin and there's nothing there. Yeah. And it's pathetic and it's untrue, but until I actually consciously say, you're all right, relax. The bills are paid, there's money there, the kids are all right, you're fine. Until I consciously say that in my head, then there's that always that that thing that other people have, you know, got to get out, got to work, got to earn my crust.
It's like you're afraid to say no to a gig because you're afraid that the next request might not come along, so you say yes
to
everything and you want to keep it coming.
I do say no. I do say no. And I say no because, for example, I might say no because I don't think the money's good enough for what they want. I just say no, you know, they say, why not? And I said, more wedge, you know, stuff like that. But other times, you know, you do stuff for free because you really want to and you think it's the right thing to do. There's people, you know, listening to this who have to do jobs they loathe, but they need to pay the bills, make sure the kids are okay. They need to do that. I'm not there. I used to work in the Simon community in Dublin when I was 15 and 16, you know, working with the homeless in Dublin and the disenfranchised, if you like. And I had a fear in my head because I deal with people who had fallen out of the net. And, you know, from their a lot of them were 50-year-old men who'd lost their family, as a result lost a job, as a result taken to drink. A lot were other, you know, unfortunate you know, what we call bag ladies or bag men, but schizophrenics and stuff. And I had a great fear that I'd end up on a park bench at 60.
Let's talk about the music briefly. You guys are coming to Hollywood's Harmony Live at the beginning of June. I would have thought, now you can correct me, that you now, 2018, you're more Hollywood USA than Hollywood County Down. Am I wrong?
I was in Hollywood last night. I just got back.
So you straddled both sides of the Atlantic.
I don't want to get on another plane in my life, which sounds glamorous. It just isn't. But at the same time, if I'm parked off at home too often, I start saying, what's wrong with you? You know, why aren't you needed someplace else? So, I mean, you know, the Rats have we've just done a big record deal with a big international company, signed off last week. The record's finished. The Americans have gone nuts over it. And that's, you know, it's amazing, you know, these kids out of South Dublin, you know, and here we are sort of going home and being in Belfast in a few weeks and wanting to be there because that is the absolute thing I love doing, besides which Belfast famously is the gig to do in the these islands. And
You have to say that, Bob. You have to sweet talk the local crowd.
Ask them. Ask any band. So where name the cities: Glasgow, Belfast, and it's a kind of toss up. But because it's Ireland, for us, that's the better one. That tops it. And so you know, that's it. And, you know, we're not going to bore the arse off people by just playing, hey, here's six tracks on the new record. You know, I actively love doing the songs from the past because I think they're mega. It's only when I'm doing them that I think this, you know, we were kids and we were writing this music and it's fantastic and I get excited in you.
If you're going to be totally honest though, do you ever, when you're doing some of the older songs, do you ever think, oh, again? What about this?
No,
I've been working on this and it's some new material and it's great.
Vinny, I would tell you, I mean, you must have the cut of my jib by now, either from this conversation or from the last 50 years or whatever. I would tell you if I was bored, stupid doing them. And at the point you're bored, you just don't do it. You know, we've got lots of songs. I mean, it's odd, but we've got lots of songs to choose from that'll kick off. And so, no, I genuinely don't.
Okay.
And, you know, I've talked to others about this, other guys in other bands, and huge bands. And I've said, you know, come on, guys, you're doing that one again. And they said, no, but when it comes round, you know, you're if you're in the gig, then you're reliving, in the same way that someone listening might remind themselves of being 18 again because of that song, or they did something at that moment when they heard that song. It's precisely the same for me. I hear the song, I'm doing it, and I'm back in, I can't actually remember maybe writing it, but I'm back in the sense of doing it. So looking after number one, our first one. When I'm there, I feel the exact same anger that I felt when I was queuing in Dunleary on a rainy November morning at 9:15. And they were supposed to open at 9 o'clock. And I didn't have a job, I got no qualifications, but I was young and I was able to go for it. But beside me were 40-year-old men. And here were these civil servants in the office having their cup of tea and making us, through no fault of our own, wait out in the biting rain while they eventually opened up the door. And that same anger over the conditions of that and what happened to people is with me when I do Looking After Number One.
That's the power of music, because it transports you back. And I guess it's the same when people are in the audience with you. Maybe they don't have that direct connection with your memory, but when they listen to a song that they know from their childhood or from their heyday, they are all of a sudden... I remember being at gigs myself.
And if they hear it for the first time, if they bring, if there's an 18-year-old there, that sense of anger and rage, that sense that should translate across them so they feel... a response.
Yeah.
And, during the depths of the crisis, and frankly during these times of still austerity, to play Rat Trap, which is a song I wrote in the Abattoir in Dublin, about just being trapped, these people I was working with and observing them, and to do Looking After Number One, or Mary the Fourth Form, or She Someone, or any of those old ones, that should work. Yeah. It's the same sense of almost helplessness in the face of these massive political or economic forces and just saying enough.
Rarely a week goes past on this programme that we don't talk about Brexit. You even took a boat up the Thames to take on Nigel Farage.
Yeah.
And now what's happening is that the concerns, well, in Northern Ireland, for example, about what will happen next as a result, the border questions... How do you feel about it now, and do you think in any way it could potentially affect the peace process here in Ireland?
Well, I think about it a lot. I couldn't have imagined in my life that the two sides of murder would stop. Just stop. Just stop, please. And they did. And in my life, I just could never have imagined it. So to be clear, I have a copy of the peace agreement framed and on my wall. And it was one of the, whatever about Blair, whatever about Trimble, whatever about Bertie, whatever about any of them, this was a crowning political achievement. And I include the representatives of the paramilitaries on both sides. I also have, so you understand how profoundly I appreciate, that is the wrong word, I've got a kind of lampshade thing into which sits a candle, which is a reproduction of all the signatures on the peace agreement. So that's how much this means to me. And to see... a third party, in fact, the party that, needed to do a lot to bring this about, to willingly put this as a poker card on the table and to gamble our serenity, our security and our peace, to use us as in a bidding war, sickens me. It sickens me, particularly as Northern Ireland elegantly and overwhelmingly voted to remain. And while I understand the Leavers' sentiment, it is nonetheless a disgrace that we should be held to hock, that our security and our peace should be held to hock.
You genuinely believe this is going to have a negative effect on the peace process here and where we've managed to get to in 2018?
Look, all of us believe that the guns have been put away. We pray, literally, we pray that that is the case. The economies of both sides of the border have stabilised to an extent. Because one of the parties in Northern Ireland holds the British government, has the leverage over the British government at the moment, you will get benefits in Northern Ireland as a result. But once that goes... I have no doubt that the economy of Northern Ireland will suffer in the same way that the economy of the United Kingdom will suffer. I cannot understand, because of a notional idea of imaginary sovereignty, why you would throw that benefit to the whole population away. The notion of shared sovereignty is one that is inherent in the idea of the United Kingdom. What is it that Belfast, Edinburgh and Cardiff do with Westminster? They share sovereignty. So sharing sovereignty with an even greater pool of 500 million people gives us a massive amount of economic leverage.
Because some think, Bob, as well, that Brexit could lead us closer to a united Ireland. Do you think there's any truth in that?
It doesn't matter what it leads to. It's just not in the interest of people on the island of Ireland that Brexit happens. But apparently it will happen. So what is in both our interests, North and South, Leaver and Remainer, is that we do everything, seriously everything, that is in our limited hands to prevent that border being erected again. It is deeply in our mutual benefit to keep that border non-existent. But even in our heads, the problem, Vinny, is there's a border in our heads. We removed it from our heads. I mean, it's an unbelievable historic achievement that brought a kind of peace to all of us. Yeah. Do not put that back. And if London imposes it again because of a misplaced and aberrant English nationalism, because that's what Rees-Mogg, that's what Johnson, that's what Davis are punting. It's an English nationalism. It's got nothing to do with Britain. It's got nothing to do with the UK. They are nationalists.
Have you ever considered a sidestep from what you do? I know you've been a campaigner for a long time, but into actual politics to run for a post?
I don't want to run for a post. I mean, you know, I can say what I like on your show. If I have to watch myself because I represent a party or because I represent constituents and I don't agree with it, I blow it. I'd be one of 620 voices in Westminster, whereas, you know, I can suggest, you know, things, you know, I can either talk overtly and openly on your show and others, or I can suggest, if it's in my head when I'm writing a song or lyrics, it's suggestive.
Come on, but if you were directly in there, Bob, you know why I'm asking. If you had...
I am directly in there. Believe me, like, I argue this through many things constantly. You know, mainly, as you know, I deal with Africa and I deal with that on a daily basis.
You could do that from within Westminster, possibly as an MP or...
But as an MP, you're almost emasculated, you know. You're redundant almost as an MP. And it's quite right that the parliamentary system is like that. You must stand on a platform that represents your party. You must do that. And as an independent, you've got no voice at all. Whereas as an independent, I stand outside. Millions of people listening to this, you know, just think, there's Geldof shooting his mouth off again. I profoundly disagree with him. He's a you know, good. That's it. Half the thing is to just, you know, throw the pebble in the water and see what happens. And I genuinely like that what's it people argue with me. And it's very Irish that we can argue.
You like a good discussion, Bob.
Walk away, shake hands and walk away. Yeah. And that's what I hope the end product of this negotiations are, that we shake hands and do whatever we do. But we shake hands on it.
The silicon chip inside her head gets switched to overload. And nobody's gonna go to school today. She's gonna make them stay at home.
The gig that's coming up in June, it's a smaller venue than you played in the past. Is it more intimate when you play? Do you have a preference?
Well, yeah, I do. I like the giant gigs. To be honest, it goes to my grandiosity, you know.
And what does it feel like when you walk out onto the stage and there are thousands of people there? They know you, they know your band, and they know your songs.
Well, you know, everyone says they get nervous, but I don't. I mean, I'm dying to. I'm itching. I want to go. And I, you know, I run out and go, yeah, you know, large it. And as I say, it isn't the guy talking to you about the border that goes out on stage. It just isn't. I know I don't want to get all David Bowie on you, but it's not that person. It's as I say, Bobby Boomtown is in the house, you know, and he larges it, and he wants that big crowd, but equally. If it's not a huge crowd, if it's a bunch of people, I don't really vary it. You know, I'm, you know, I'm. I, it's it's deeply personal. It's something else is going on.
I would assume being part of a band is a very personal thing. You spend and have done over the years a lot of time together. So what are those relationships like now, 40 years down the line?
That's a really good question because I've thought about that. At first, you're a bunch of guys generally from the neighbourhood who may or may not know each other pretty well. You know, none of them were my big mates, but I knew them from the pub or I knew them from... You know, and if they were in the pub, you'd sit down, but they would, you know, you'd hang occasionally. And then, you know, the bass player knows the drummer, so he brings him in and, you know, you get to know them. And you know, at the first it's a laugh and then it gets deeply serious and suddenly it's full on all the time and you get exhausted and, you know, it's not kind of what you thought. Because you've got rivals. Are we selling more tickets than The Clash? Are we selling more records than Elvis Costello? Where's the next song, Bob? Because, you know, we need a new... The record company's saying, we've got to get into the top 10 with this one, or we've got to get into the top 5, or we've got to get into the top 3. And suddenly people are dependent almost on you for a job. Like
it's pressure
the crew, the management. And it's not what you thought.
And does it affect those relationships then with those people?
Well, it does because you know it's so tight. You're every sec. We moved to England. We lived all together in one house for a year and a half, and we got on well. But you know, you're not just living in a house. You're traveling in a bus. Yeah. You're on a plane, side by side by side, sleeping up against each other, sharing rooms constantly.
Yeah.
So then you meet the girl or whatever. And there's, you know, this is necessary. It's called growing up, and you find a more profound relationship. But still, the records tend to change at that point, and your relationship with the band is one of, like, coming together, like, going to work.
No fallouts or disagreements?
Huge fallouts and disagreements. But then you get older, and you're just guys who've lived through this extraordinary...
Yeah.
experience together, and no one else truly gets that. And in fact, so this is true, and I'm not just saying it because we're going to be in Hollywood in a couple of days, the understanding on stage is entirely instinctive and intuitive now, and there's nothing more to be said except that somehow this random group of individuals make a sound unique to them. Put another guy in there, it doesn't work. Unique to them. That is deeply thrilling and exciting.
Bob Geldof and, of course, the Boomtown Rats coming to Harmony Live in Hollywood on June the 2nd. Bob, it has been a real delight to talk to you this morning. Thank you.
Thanks, Vinny. Bye. Machine is kept so.